Okay, last week we covered the Incipit, chapter 1, verse 1. Should take about a year and a half to get through the book. At the rate we're going, should take about a decade, right? And the plan for today is to cover the entire Gospel of Mark in one teaching. How does that sound? Apparently not very good. This is a painting by my buddy Cam Van Loan, who's a local street artist. And genius of a guy, I called him up a few days ago. I said, hey man, do you have a painting I could borrow for the weekend? He said, how about I make you one just for this weekend's teaching? I said, absolutely. Now, it's 7 feet long, okay? In order to get the full effect, you have to step back and take in the whole work, right? The same is true with the Gospel of Mark. But here's the problem. What we do, because we walk really slowly through the text, what we do every week is kind of like looking at a piece of art through a magnifying glass, right? We dig in and we scrutinize and we observe and we look really close at every detail and every kind of knit and noid and everything in there because, and that's not all bad, it was written thousands of years ago in another language, in another culture, and it's really easy to miss stuff. It's not bad at all to study the Bible that way, line by line. But the problem is, in order to take in the whole thing, you really have to step back. And that's the plan for today. I want to step back and look at all of the masterpiece, the artwork that is the Gospel of Mark. Now, here's the path. First off, we'll cover background, stuff like author, date, original audience, because we believe that the Gospel of Mark was written for us, but it was not written to us. Meaning it's written for everybody, down through history and all over the world, but it's not written to you and me. It's written to the church in the first century. We need to ask questions. Who is Mark? When is he writing? Who is he writing to? Why? What's the point, right? After that, then we'll overview the entire book in about 10 minutes in theory, or if it doesn't go well, 20. Then we'll wrap up with implications for you and me. Sound all right? No, three of you are excited. I like the three of you. Well done. This one goes out to all three of you. Should take about 50 minutes. It's going to feel like you're in seminary. I'm sorry. I'm not really sorry, but I say that to be nice. And if you don't like it, the regular guy will be back next week. First off, let's start off with background. First, author. Who is writing? Well, that one's easy. The title says, in Greek, it's Euangelion Kata Markon, or the Gospel of, or according to, or by Mark. Mark is a figure that we read about all over the New Testament. He was the son of a wealthy widower in the city of Jerusalem named Mary. We think Mark's house was used in Jerusalem by Jesus and the 12 disciples for the Last Supper. We know Mark's house was used by the early church for prayer. You know that story in Acts where Peter's in prison, the early church is praying, and Peter gets out in a miraculous story, knocks on the door, and the teenager says, you know, it's not Peter, it's just Peter's angel. You know that bizarre story? And I was like, well, let the angel in, seriously, right? That's at Mark's house. We first read about in Acts chapter 12 when he goes on a journey with Paul and Barnabas. He's called by two names, John and Mark, which I gotta say is a fabulous combination. You know, masculine, forceful, unique, but not weird. I mean, I really like the double name. Actually, he would not have gone by John Mark. In Mark's day, if you were Jewish, you would go by two names. You would go by a Jewish name when you were with your family and friends, and then you would go by a Greek name when you were out and about, because Greek was the language of the day. Think of Saul and Paul, or Cephas and Peter, or John, Hebrew name, and Mark, Greek name. Now, Mark traveled with his uncle Barnabas and Paul for a while before falling out. But then, by the time of Paul's writings, all is well, and Mark, one more time, is working with Paul. So this is a guy who was well-known in the early church. He was there from the beginning in Jerusalem. I mean, the Last Supper, we think, was in Mark's living room, right? And worked with Paul, and then later with Peter, and we think was probably a well-respected teacher and writer in the church. But Mark is not alone. The earliest writing we have on Mark is from a guy named Papias, the bishop of Hierapolis, right next to Metropolis. He writes this. That was really not funny. Okay. Mark became Peter's interpreter and wrote accurately all that he remembered. Peter probably spoke Aramaic, and Mark is educated from Jerusalem and interpreter into Greek, and wrote accurately all that he remembered, for Mark had not heard the Lord, nor had he followed him. He was not one of the 12 disciples, but later on, as I said, followed Peter, who used to give teaching. For to one thing he, Mark, gave attention, to leave out nothing of what he had heard and to make no false statements in them. The leading theory is that Peter is the eyewitness source, but Mark is the literary genius behind the gospel. On that note, don't underestimate the power of just telling your story, just telling what God has done in your life. And don't underestimate the power of just telling Jesus' story. Remember last week, this whole thing, chapter 1 to chapter 16, it's all the gospel. The gospel is not a formula. The gospel is a person, Jesus. Don't underestimate the power of just telling your story. I think sometimes we feel this pressure to be salesmen for Jesus. Do you ever feel that, or is that just me? That's just me. Okay. I think so. Like, you have to sell people on Jesus. Like, you have to package and market and persuade and argue. And listen, and no, that's not bad, per se. But you're not called a salesman. You're called a witness in the scriptures. What's the job of a witness? Anybody? Yeah, just to testify. You tell your story. Here's what I saw. Here's what happened. That's all you're called to do. Here's what I saw. Jesus changed my life. Here's what happened. Jesus' birth, life, teachings, inbreaking kingdom, death, resurrection. Your job is just to tell everybody you know, family, friends, your story, what God's done in your life, and Jesus' story, any part of it, all of it, from beginning to end. Now, moving on. Next up is date. When? Well, Mark is the earliest of all four Gospels, as far as we can tell, predating Matthew and Luke and John. It's written in the middle of the 60s, which is a time of turbulence all over the world. By the way, I mean the 60s AD, not the 1960s, which were also a time of turbulence. Some of you bear the scars, but we're really happy you're here. Now, in the 60s AD, Israel, for example, was at war with Rome from 66 to 70 in the Jewish revolt, and the empire was in upheaval. Caesar Nero, one of the most powerful and demonic men in human history, was going insane, literally. He set fire to the city of Rome, but blamed it on the church. A few years after that, he was declared a public enemy of the state by the Roman Senate, and he committed suicide. One Roman historian, Tacitus, writes about the empire in the 60s, quote, "The history on which I'm entering is that of a period rich in disasters, terrible battles, torn by civil struggles, horrible even in peace. Four emperors fell by the sword. After Caesar Nero, there was no clear heir to the throne, and there were four Caesars, four sons of God in 2 years, all fighting for control of the empire. There were three civil wars, more foreign wars, one with Israel, often both at the same time. Italy was distressed by disasters unknown before, returning after the lapse of the ages. Beside the manifold misfortunes that befell mankind, there were prodigies in the sky and on the earth, warnings given by thunderbolts and prophecies of the future, both joyful and gloomy, uncertain and clear. This is a scary time to be alive, much less to follow Jesus. Wow, this is a dangerous time to be alive," which is why, as far as we can tell, the audience Mark is writing to was being persecuted. Now, Mark does not say anything about who he is writing to. It's not like Paul's letters that start off to the church of God in Corinth or Philippi or Ephesus, okay? In part because the Gospels, all four, were designed to be passed around, to be circulated through the church. You would take Mark's Gospel, you would read, and you would pass it to the next house church, pass it to the next house church, pass it to the next city, pass it to the next territory in Rome. But based on the text, we think that Mark is writing to Romans. There are all sorts of hints and clues. Mark has to explain anything Jewish. Mark has to translate Aramaic into Greek. He uses Latin words and phrases, and he sees Romans in a positive light, which is really unique to Mark. Quite a few scholars think he's writing from the city of Rome to the church in the city of Rome. But whether or not that's true, he's writing to an audience who's being persecuted. when Caesar Nero blamed the fire of Rome on the Christians, he unleashed an empire-wide persecution in which millions of followers of Jesus, before that it was isolated here, there, leaders, but after that, millions of followers of Jesus were put to death, for the most part, in the arena for sport all over the empire. Tacitus, the Roman historian, one more time, writes, he, Nero, punished with the utmost refinements of cruelty or torture a class of men despised for their vices, whom the crowd called Christians. The confessed members of the sect were arrested. Then on their confessions that Jesus is Lord, is what it would have sounded like, huge numbers were convicted, not so much on the charge of arson, that was disproven, as for hatred of the human race. And mocking accompanied their end. They were covered with the skins of wild animals, torn to death by dogs, or they were hung on crosses. And when sunlight failed, they were burned to serve as lamps at night. We think that chapter 1, verse 13 is a reference to the persecution. The text says Jesus was with the wild animals. We think that's Mark's way of saying, hey, those of you in the arena, those of you being eaten alive, literally, Jesus was like that. Jesus was with you. He knows what that is like, which is good news, right? This book isn't just for people who have it all together, right? And have all everything in a row and nice and neat and tidy. This is a book for people who are suffering. Now, to be honest, we don't really know much about suffering in general, much less persecution. Am I right? By the grace of God, we live in safety and security in the U.S. Around the world, Christians are by far the most persecuted people group in the world. That's getting worse, not better. There are more followers of Jesus put to death for faith in the modern world than ever before in human history. The Arab Spring, I read one article a few days ago by a non-believer that said the Arab Spring is now turning into the Christian winter. Iraq, for all the PR that you get, 2/3 of followers of Jesus in the last 10 years, ever since the war, have fled from Iraq because of persecution, death, torture, but they're in Libya and Syria now, which is frankly not any better. It's really brutal. But here in America, well, that's obviously not the case, but we do, and this is one fraction of that, we do bear a cultural shame for following Jesus, which is a unique development in the history of America. It's now, in particular, you are now looked down upon for following Jesus, in particular by people under the age of, say, 40. You bear that shame. Some of you know that all too well. You have been rejected by family and friends for your faith in Jesus. Listen, you are not alone. That has been going on for a long time. Followers of Jesus thrown to wild animals in the arena in this story. And Jesus knows what that like. He was executed by the Roman government. He was rejected by his own family and friends. And Jesus is with you. That's what Mark is saying. It's written to people who are suffering. Now, last up, genre. What kind of book is Mark? Well, it's a biography, plain and simple. And it's about who? Jesus of Nazareth. That means, and please listen to me right now, Jesus is the central character in the story. Not Peter, not James, not John, not Satan, not the chief priest, not Herod, not Pilate. Jesus is the central character in the story. You know, if you're anything like me, you live as if you are the central character in the story of life. Am I alone in that? I guess I am. Well, okay. That's one of the reasons that so many people don't like reading the Bible, because we come to it like a self-help book. What can I get out of it? The number one critique I have from honest people, and I appreciate that, is, yeah, when I read the Bible, I don't get anything out of it. And I mean, sympathy, absolutely. It's why we have the House of Learning. It's why we have a hermeneutics class. It's why we have recommended reading for you to understand and read the scriptures every single day. How often? Every single day. That is my prayer for every single one of you, 365 days a year. But part of the reason so many people have a hard time with the Bible is because we come to it asking the wrong set of questions. We open up a chapter from thousands of years ago and we're thinking, how can my marriage get better? How can my job get better? How can my career get better? How can my happiness get better? And that's not all bad. Like, the Bible is filled with wisdom for human flourishing. Whether you believe in Jesus or not, the way of Jesus is the best way to live. But ultimately, not to be harsh, but the Bible is not a story about you, right? It's a story about God. God is at the center of the story. You and I are secondary in that narrative. And Mark, that is 110% true. Mark is a story, a biography about Jesus of Nazareth. Now, all of that background out of the way, let's move on to overview. Let's cover the entire book in 10 minutes, but don't hold me to that. Don't time me. Here we go, all right? Now, Mark, where are we? Ladies and gentlemen, this is like prop weekend, okay? Yes, we are getting academic today, all right? You just feel smart right now, don't you? No, I do. Anyway, doesn't happen to me very often. Mark can be bifurcated into two major sections, chapter 1 to 8 and chapters 9 to 16. The first half, or the first block, takes place up in the Galilee, in the north of Israel, in villages, for the most part, with a peasant class. The second half, on the other hand, takes place on the way to and in the city of Jerusalem with the aristocracy for the Passover. The first block takes place over a period of about 3 years, but the second block takes place over a period of a few weeks. In fact, 11 to 16 take place over 1 week for Passover. Interesting. One scholar I read called Mark a passion story with an extended introduction, because the whole story is leading up to Jesus' death and resurrection. Now, the first block, 1 to 8, is essentially saying the king is here and his name is Jesus. And by king, I mean Messiah. That's Jewish language for a coming anointed king. That's essentially what the first half of the book is about. Mark starts off with the encipid. You remember that from last week, chapter 1, verse 1, the beginning of the gospel about Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God. And you, the reader, are introduced into the three major storylines running all the way through Mark: Eden, Israel, and Rome. If you were not here last week, go back and listen to the podcast. Then, in chapter 1, 2 to 13, you're introduced to the prologue, which really sets up the book. Now, Mark's style is fast-paced, boom, boom, boom. I mean, it's 16 chapters long. It's short, right? And Mark doesn't have time for Jesus' birth or genealogy or the Christmas story. He skips forward and starts, hits the ground running with John the Baptizer. Now, the prologue is crucial because it's really the frame for the entire book. We're going to cover it next week. And in it, we read about Jesus' baptism, where the heavens are torn open and the voice from the sky, God's voice, says, if you look down at chapter 1, verse 11, "You are my son, whom I love. With you I am well pleased." Now, this is interesting because the only other place that happens is in chapter 9 on the Mount of Transfiguration. The exact same thing. Heaven, voice from heaven, "This is my son, whom I love. Listen to him." Which is interesting. The first block of writing and the second block of writing both start off with the revelation that Jesus is the Son of God. Then out of that revelation, here's what happens. In chapter 1, we read about Jesus' power in three things specifically: healings and exorcisms and miracles. And there's so much good stuff in there. Then we read about Jesus' authority in chapters 2 and 3. Jesus has authority over nature, authority over the demonic kingdom, authority over the Sabbath, authority over Jewish tradition. Then in chapter 4, there's kind of a break in the story, and it's a whole chapter of parables, which are kingdom stories. Jesus is saying, okay, let's take a deep breath. This is what's happening in and through my work. Then in chapters 5 to 8, we read about Jesus forming a brand new community. He starts by sending out 12 apostles, symbolic for the 12 tribes of Israel. It's Mark's way of saying that Jesus is forming a renewed Israel around himself. Now, if you forget that, no worries at all. All of that is leading up to chapter 8, verses 27 to 30, which is the fulcrum point for the entire book. It's the hinge between the two blocks of writing. Turn there, Mark chapter 8, to the right, a few pages. You alive? You okay? All right. You're like, dude, it's my day off. I feel like I'm in school. I'm sorry. I'm not really sorry, but let's keep reading. Mark 8, Jesus goes up to Caesarea Philippi, which is to the north outside of Israel, deep in pagan territory, which is deeply symbolic. More on that when we get there. Let's read the story. Chapter 8, 27. Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, "Who do people say I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, still others, one of the prophets." "What about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Peter answered, "You are the Messiah." This is a watershed moment. Peter, for the first time, gets it. This rabbi is more than a rabbi. This prophet is more than a prophet. This is the Messiah, which is a Jewish word, like I said, for the coming anointed king. But then watch what happens next. 30, Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. How strange is that? Like, what's up with that? He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this. Wow. Jesus, this is the first right here of three passion prophecies. There's another one in chapter 9 and another one in chapter 10. Jesus is driving the point home. Listen, Peter, James, John, reader, listen. I am going to Jerusalem, yes, as king, but I am going to die. In essence, what is happening from right here, the hinge, all the way to the end, is that that Mark is saying, yes, Jesus is the king, yes, Jesus is the Messiah, but he's not the kind of king you're expecting. You're expecting a king to show up and muster an army and fight off the Roman oppressors and lead Israel to global power and world domination and to usher in an age. Well, he's not that kind of king. Instead, he's going to Jerusalem to suffer and in the end to die. Instead of coming to bring judgment, Jesus, the Messiah, is here to bear judgment. Instead of coming to punish the world for sin, Jesus, he is here to take on the world's sin, dying in the world's place, and the same is true for you and me, and in doing so to heal the rupture at the fabric of the universe. That's what Jesus is saying. But the disciples, for obvious reasons, don't take the news very well. Keep reading. He spoke plainly about this, 32. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Not very intelligent. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter, "Get behind me, Satan." Which is at the top of the list of things you don't want to hear from the Son of God. Right? He said, "You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns. You don't get how God thinks, how I think, how God operates, how I operate. You don't understand the kingdom of God." Then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples, and he said, "Listen, this is the invitation of Jesus." Okay, this is the center of the Gospel of Mark. "Whoever wants to be my disciple or student or apprentice must deny themselves and take up their" what? "Cross," symbolic for death, "and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. Whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it." Jesus obviously did not have a PR guy, right? Now, I mean, his invitation is catchy. I'll give him that. Hey, come, die, follow me. It's catchy, right? It's idiosyncratic, but it's not, I mean, really, Jesus? That's it? Yes, that is the invitation of Jesus. Jesus calls his followers not to take up arms against Rome and go the way of violence and military power, but rather to follow him down this path of death, burial, and resurrection. And that is exactly what happens. In chapters 10 and 12, Jesus comes to Jerusalem as king, but he's riding on a donkey, symbolic for peace, not on a stallion, symbolic for victory. Then in chapter 13 is what's called by scholars the little apocalypse, because it's kind of like a condensed version of the book of Revelation in one chapter. Some scholars or some people think it's about the end of the world. I think it's about the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. More on that in a few months. After that, Jesus is put on trial by the chief priests for sedition. He's arrested and he's executed by the Roman government on the cross. But 3 days later, what happens? Resurrection, the first Easter Sunday morning. Then the ending of the book, chapter 16, 9 to 20, is contested. More on that in about a year. Now, one more thing. One more thing before we move on. Scholars eat Mark up because it's such a work of literary genius. Now, for hundreds of years, Mark was ignored in scholarship, at least in the West, because it was eclipsed by Matthew. 95% of Mark is in Matthew, but Matthew's Jesus is way easier to understand, and there's teaching, and he sits on the side of a mountain and talks about flowers and birds. He's great, right? Mark is, you know, tense and scary and nervous and jittery and confusing and cryptic and fast-paced, right? And for years, Mark was ignored by scholarship until about the year 1970, when a group of literary critics discovered the Gospel of Mark. People who read novels and stuff like that. How many of you love like a good novel on a rainy day? Yeah, people like you, okay? Discovered the Gospel of Mark and said, holy cow, in particular, if you set Mark in context, the first century AD, this is a brilliant work of art. And ever since, it's been on the vanguard of scholarship because we're realizing, gosh, Mark, who is the earliest gospel, is a genius storyteller. Now, what the literary critics pointed out is that in essence, Mark is a mystery story. And the mystery or the question at the heart of Mark's story is, who is Jesus? Now, what's interesting is you, the reader, are introduced to Jesus in the opening line, in the incipit, right? Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God. Right off the bat, if you're reading Mark, you know who Jesus is. You know Jesus is the Messiah. You know Jesus is the Son of God. But nobody in the story knows that. You know that, God knows that from the baptism, this is my son, and the demons know that. Interesting, the only characters with good theology in all of Mark are the demons. True story. But nobody else does. Jesus' family doesn't know. Jesus' disciples in the dark, the chief priests, the Pharisees, the scribes in the dark, the Roman government in the dark, nobody knows. And this question is running all the way. I dare you to read through all of Mark in one sitting. It's really like, I did it a few days ago and I was like anxious the whole time. You're running all the way through. In chapter 2, after Jesus is forgiving sins, the people ask the question, who is this? In chapter 4, the disciples ask the question, who is this? The wind, the waves obey him. In chapter 6, Herod asks, who is this? And Herod thinks it's John the Baptist resurrected, right? He's wrong. Then in chapter 8, Jesus says, who do men say I am, right? And then he says, Peter, who do you say I am? Peter says, you're the Messiah. Now, he's halfway there, right? Jesus is the Messiah, but he does not yet understand that Jesus is more than just the coming anointed king of Israel and the world. Jesus is also the Son of God. Peter is not there yet. In fact, all the way, at this point in the story, you could cut the tension with the knife, right? When you're reading chapter 8, because you are the Messiah, you're thinking, yes, 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 come on, come on, you're almost there. Then you get to chapter 14, and Jesus is put on trial by the chief priest, and the chief priest says, who do you say you are? Are you the Messiah? Are you the Son of the Blessed? Which is another way of saying the Son of God. And what does Jesus say? Yes, yes, right, finally, you get it, thank you. But does the chief priest believe? No, he says, blasphemy, rips open his clothing, says, you shall die, right? The secret at this point is not out. The secret is all the way through. Jesus keeps saying, don't tell people, don't tell people. Oh, I know I healed you. Don't tell people. Oh, I know I healed you. Don't tell people. You're thinking, why is Jesus saying that? It's not until chapter 15, verse 39, that the secret is out in the open. Right after Jesus' death, the next verse, first thing you read is the Roman centurion saying, what, anybody know? Yes, truly this man was the Son of God, which is ironic for two reasons. One, because it's a Roman military officer who is the first one that gets Jesus is the Son of God. That his boss, Caesar, is the parody, Jesus is the reality. It's not a Jew, it's not Peter, it's not James, it's not John, it's a Roman military officer. Fascinating, since Mark is probably writing to people who are being persecuted by Roman centurions. Secondly, it's ironic because it's not until after the death of the Messiah, which was an oxymoron in the ancient world, the idea of a crucified Messiah, it's not until after Jesus' death that the secret is out that Jesus is the Son of God. Why is that? Well, it's Mark's way of saying you can never truly understand God. And you can never truly understand what it means for Jesus to be the Son of God until the cross. Because the cross is the ultimate revelation of the character of God. It's on the cross that we see what God is like, giving himself away in self-sacrificial love for the good of the world. That's what God is like. And the phrase Messiah and Son of God are meaningless until you see Jesus on the cross. That's why all the way through, Jesus is saying, don't tell anybody, don't tell anybody, don't tell anybody, because Jesus is redefining Messiahship, what it means to be the king, and the Son of God, what it means to be the Son of God and what God is like. All that to say, what Mark is about is Jesus' identity. Jesus is the Messiah and the Son of God. Now, we're done with all the overview. Are you alive? You breathing? You okay? Well done. All right. To wrap up, let's think about implications. What does any and all of this mean for you and me, thousands of years later on the other side of the world? Well, to start off, we don't really get the idea of Jesus as king, right? I mean, king is not language used by you and me for the most part, because we live in a democracy. And in a democracy, in a sense, every man is his own king. The same is true of a woman, right? The president of the United States technically is an employee of the people. We vote the man or woman in a few years, whether you like it or not, in and out of office, right? I mean, he's technically an employee of the people. And that's the beauty of democracy. You're free to do whatever the heck you want for the most part, as long as you don't hurt or harm other people. And this idea of a king is strange and alien, but this is the backbone of the gospel of Jesus. And I would argue, even though that language is strange, I would argue that we all have a king. We all have someone or something that we make ultimate, that we sacrifice for, that we serve, that we give time and energy and money to. You know, you might be your own king, or your body might be your own king, or your career might be your own king, or the socioeconomic nudge of culture that you like might be your own king. But we all have a king. We all have something that's ultimate. We're all following something. We're all being discipled by something, meaning we're all being formed by something. The question is, what is it for you? Who is your king? What is your king? What are you following? What do you serve and worship and sacrifice? By worship, I don't mean sing to. I mean, what do you give to? What do you give your life to? What do you think about? What do you obsess about? What do you worry about? What do you follow after? What do you love? What do you get excited about? What do you talk about? What is it? What are you being discipled by? What are you being formed by? The invitation of Jesus is to follow him, and to follow him as king, not as life coach, not as pal, not as romantic date, right? You remember that t-shirt from a few years ago, Jesus is my homeboy, right? I think it started with Ashton Kutcher, and then it spread to Urban Outfitters, and then it was ubiquitous for about 6 months, right? That is the zeitgeist of my generation. Jesus, sure, yeah, I like the guy. He's great, Bible, church, all that stuff, nah. But Jesus, yeah, he's my homeboy. My peeps, right? I mean, absolutely. He's my pal. Jesus is there for me, right? But there's nothing about Jesus, the king of the world. But the invitation of Jesus is to come and die. That's why I still think Jesus needs a PR guy, right? Any of you work in marketing? Any Wieden and Kennedy people? Jesus needs you, right? Because his invitation is essentially, come die. And on the other side of the cross is resurrection. On the other side of sacrifice and deny yourself and pick up your cross is what one author called life abundant. Joy and peace and hope and meaning, but it's on the other side of the cross. That's the invitation of Jesus. Now, my problem, and maybe I'm alone today, it sounds like I am for the most part. my problem is that I don't want to die. And I don't want a king. I'm doing fine as my own king, thank you very much. I don't want to enjoy life. I want to get my paycheck and go out to brunch at Tasty and Sons and get coffee at Cova and buy stuff and hang out and go see a movie and go for a run, hang out with my family, my friends, and sure, I want God, absolutely. The same way I want cream in my coffee in the morning, you know? Kind of make life a little easier. And when I'm desperate, oh yeah, when life's hard or I'm depressed or, you know, whatever, oh, for sure, then I want God. I want God. But I don't want to die. I want to believe, sure. I don't want to follow. You all understand those are not synonyms, right? Believing in Jesus or following Jesus, you get those are not synonyms. You get you can believe in Jesus and not be one of his followers. You understand that, right? You can believe in your head. You can be right with God. You can be saved. If you die today, great. And you cannot be a follower of Jesus. Happens all the time. And I don't think I'm alone. In fact, I'm seeing this disturbing trend all over America right now. And I like to think of myself as open-minded, theologically as well as philosophically, right? All that kind of stuff. I'm friends with people from all over the map when it comes to the church, Catholic, Protestant, all that stuff, right? But it's really disconcerting to me. What I'm seeing, you know, the prosperity gospel, which anytime you put a word in front of the word gospel, I'm out. Like prosperity, social reform, I don't care. I'm out. If it's gospel and Jesus, I'm in. But the prosperity gospel used to be on the fringe of the church in kind of really small, out there, hyper-Pentecostal churches. But the mainstream, everybody knows it's ridiculous. Everybody knows Jesus is not here to like be your cosmic vending machine, right? We all know that. Sickness is a part. We get that, right? But what's happened is over the years, in particular with a few preachers, one that is for sale in Costco and smiles a lot, is that the prosperity should not have said that. The prosperity gospel is now spreading to the mainstream. And it's funny, there's all this talk right now about Jesus. And I'm a fan of that, like Jesus, yes, absolutely. But it's funny, sometimes if you listen, it's not the Jesus rooted in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. It's not Jesus, the first century rabbi, prophet, Messiah, son of God. It's Jesus, the junk drawer for all things spiritual. Jesus, the warm, fuzzy feeling I get when I do God stuff. Jesus, the life enhancer. And I'm scared that Jesus is fast becoming a moniker for self-help. Go to Powell's. What's the largest section of that bookstore in everyone in America? Self-help. Like, I've never been there. That's okay, right? Millions of other Americans have. And Jesus is kind of lumped right in there next to the Dalai Lama and yoga and karma and John Maxwell. And great, Jesus, fabulous, thank you. Take him after my antidepressant, before my yoga workout, and after my 5 lessons of successful living, right? Jesus, sure, great. Jesus is not a self-help guru. Don't get me wrong. He is a helper, absolutely. He's the way to life. But Jesus is the king of the world. Do you believe that? And when I criticize other churches or other followers of Jesus, I'm doing that because I see that in me. At least they're honest about it. I see that bent in my own heart. I want a God who exists for me. I want to be the main character in my story. And sure, I want God in my story as a supporting actor. He should get an Academy for Best Supporting Actor. But I want to be the main character. It's my life. Is that true or false? It's false. You were bought with a price, therefore glorify God with your body, end quote, Paul to the Corinthians. You have been rescued. You belong to the living God. You're not just a believer, you are a disciple, a follower of God in Jesus. And your life is not about your life. Your story is not about your story. It's wrapped up in something larger and bigger and deeper and far more interesting. Following Jesus is about reorienting your life, reorienting your orbit around Jesus. Jesus, you're the main character. Jesus, you are the center. I'm on the periphery. I'm following you. That is why all I'm saying, my friends, is that as a church, we have to stay focused on Jesus. Would you agree? Following Jesus day in, day out, learning from Jesus, reading the scriptures, learn and worshiping Jesus every single day. Now, to that end, we want to end with a challenge, and please listen to me right now. We want to end with a challenge for every last one of you to read the Gospels every single, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, anyone, every single day between now and the end of the year. To read a block, three or four chapters, or a whole book, or one chapter, or one story, which should take you about 2 minutes, okay? Every single day, and to pray two simple, easy prayers. First off, Jesus, show me who you are. Right? Show me what you're like. We believe that Jesus is the manifestation of God. In praying that, you're praying, God, show me what you're like. And Jesus, show me how to follow you. I don't live in the first century. I don't walk around on a dirt road with you, the rabbi. I'm an engineer for Intel. I'm a marketing exec for Nike. I'm a stay-at-home mom. I'm a second grade teacher. I'm a barista. I own a business. You fill in the blank. I'm a student. Show me how to follow you. Now, here's the rhythm. Next slide. Every morning, do it at night, whatever. It's not legalistic. For me, it's the morning, but whatever. First off, you pray. Jesus, show me what you're like. Show me how to follow you. Then secondly, you read a chapter or a book or one story, whatever, but every single day. How often? Every day, 365, or how many days are left in the year. Third, you listen. After that, you close your Bible and you clear your head and you listen to the Spirit of God. Don't rush off out the door to work or school. You listen to the Spirit of God. Prayer is a two-way street. And then last, you live out. Whatever you read about that morning, go do it, right? Heck, this is Portland. Just do it, all right? Like, seriously, you read about generosity, go share stuff or money or time or whatever. You read about worship, go worship. You read about forgiveness, pick up the phone, make things right. Have what Bob Goff calls a Bible doing, right? Every day should be a Bible doing. You pray, you read, you listen, you live out. What would happen if every single one of you, thousands of followers of Jesus, not only from this church, but all over the city, did that? Easy. 10 minutes every day. You read the Gospels, you pray, Jesus, show me what you're like, show me how to follow you. What would happen to this city? What happened to this church? What would happen to your marriage, your family, your body, your soul, your future, your budget, your every square inch of who you are? What would happen? I think you would start to look more and more like Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God.